This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, filling in for Neil Conan. Tomorrow, Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney is expected to sign into law a plan that promises health care coverage for nearly everybody in the state, 6.3 million people. The plan is billed as the best of all worlds, or at least something to appease all sides, a mix of personal responsibility and government support, a bipartisan effort spearheaded by a Republican governor and approved by mostly Democratic lawmakers. Under the new plan, the uninsured will be required to buy private plans, with the cost to vary based on income. The state agrees to step in and subsidize the cost when necessary. It will also impose financial penalties on businesses that don't insure their employees, as well as uninsured people who refuse to buy a plan. The idea is that the law will create a larger insurance pool, which will bring down the cost of expensive private plans. While some argue the numbers don't add up, the country has its eyes on Massachusetts to see if the plan can be a recipe for broader reform. Later in the program, a new federal law will require anyone seeking Medicaid coverage to show proof of U.S. citizenship. But first, the Massachusetts health care plan. We'd especially like to hear from our callers in the Bay State. If you're uninsured or own a small business, what do you make of the plan? If you live outside Massachusetts, do you think this could work in your state? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And joining us now is Jonathan Gruber, a health economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He advised Governor Romney and the State House on the health reform law. He's with us now from a studio at Barclan Productions in Watertown, Massachusetts. Welcome, Professor.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, and getting better all the time now that I think everybody's going to have health insurance. So I feel good about that. There have been other attempts at universal coverage before. What makes this proposal different?
I think what makes this proposal different is it's, as you mentioned, it's got something for everyone. It's got universal coverage and large subsidies for low-income populations, which the left can like. And it's got individual responsibility through the individual mandate that the right can like. It really is trying to think about a sensible middle road to get to this elusive goal of universal coverage.
What kind of coverage do you think people would get under this plan?
Well, basically that is largely still to be determined. The legislation lays down that there are certain parameters the coverage has to meet. It has to include a number of the state-mandated benefits for coverage of illnesses. It can't have deductibles for low-income families. It must be free for those below the poverty line. But many of the details are still to be worked out.
But is your vision – well, first of all, would it replace Medicaid? Is that the idea?
No.
No.
No. The vision is not to replace Medicaid. Really, the vision is – I think another reason this plan is successful is because the vision is to really build upon what we have now that works.
It would assume catastrophic coverage, right? So you get hit by a car, you don't have to worry, presumably.
Yeah, at a minimum. I think my guess is the resulting plan will be much more comprehensive than that, but at a minimum that will be covered.
What about basic preventive care? I mean, this is obviously one of the great conundrums is that people who don't have insurance tend to ignore routine conditions that then subsequently become very serious. Like they don't see somebody about high blood pressure and then it gets – then until they go to the hospital. You know, they don't see somebody about a cut until it gets infected. So what about kind of basic routine kinds of things that you and I would go and take care of?
That's exactly why this is such an exciting development, which is that's the reason that being uninsured is such a problem. It's a problem because people aren't getting the basic preventive care that can both improve their health and be cost effective. And that's why we need to get them insurance coverage. And that will certainly be covered by any plan that's included in this package.
But what are you calling? I mean, what are you – is there a parameter? Is there a floor?
At this point, really, the legislation is almost more of a framework than details. It's basically following the key principles of setting up a place where everyone can go to get good health insurance, the kind that you get from NPR or I get from MIT. It allows people who right now don't have that access to get that access through what we call the connector. It subsidizes that insurance so that it's affordable, and it mandates that everyone have coverage. But beyond that, the details are largely to be worked out. There's still a lot of questions to be answered.
Well, one of the questions is that supporters are comparing it to car insurance. They say that, look, if you have a car, you have to have insurance. There's no Nobody argues about that. But the difference is the state doesn't penalize people who don't own cars. So, but you can't, under this plan, you can't choose not to participate. How do you justify that? And I don't mean to be judgmental in the use of that word, but I can't think of another word to say. How do you justify requiring people to do something like that? They can't opt out.
I think there are two ways that you can justify that, and two ways to think about it. One is that healthcare is something which is a basic good, which is something that people should all be able to avail themselves of, and that if individuals aren't covered, they might not use the healthcare most effectively, as you just mentioned. The second is if individuals aren't covered and they get sick, they get care now, they just don't pay for it. So that's the individual responsibility piece, is to redirect that uncompensated care, those funds where individuals use care and don't compensate for it, to covering everyone who's uninsured.
But what's your theory on why people aren't getting insurance now? I mean, is the operating theory here that people aren't getting insurance because they're irresponsible or because it's too expensive?
I think it's really both. I think a lot of it is because – it's really three reasons. One is because there's often not a good place to go to get it. Right now, if you aren't offered insurance by your employer, you're in what I like to call the sixth circle of hell, or the non-group insurance market, where insurance can be very expensive, prices can be volatile, they can go up and down, they can go up a lot in a given year, and often things just aren't covered. So even if you can afford it, you might not be able to find it. Second of all, even when you solve that problem, there's just the question health insurance is expensive. Even a fairly modest health insurance plan is at least $10,000 a year for a family. That's just too expensive for many families. So basically, then third of all, there are people who can afford it, who have access to good health insurance, who just figure, look, the only thing that's going to happen to me is to get hit by a car. If I get hit by a car, it'll be covered anyway. So why should I bother spending a few thousand dollars for health insurance?
How do you know that people are making those kinds of judgments?
What you know is, you know, there's a large number of people who are eligible for highly subsidized health insurance and don't take it. I'll point out two facts to make this point. First of all, one quarter of the uninsured are individuals who work at firms that offer health insurance, who are offered that health insurance typically at a very highly subsidized rate, but still turn it down. Second of all, 8 million of the 11 million uninsured children in America are already eligible for free public health insurance and don't take it. That's two examples where many individuals are eligible for free or highly subsidized insurance and aren't taking advantage of it.
But those are children. So presumably the adults are the gatekeeper here.
Exactly.
But why are the adults not signing up?
Once again, I can point out the facts that are there. We have less understanding of what the problem is. Some of it with the public insurance, maybe the individuals don't know they're eligible. Maybe there's a stigma that they don't want to be in public insurance. Or quite frankly, maybe they just figure, look, the kid's healthy. I'm not going to worry about it now. When they get sick, I'll sign them up. The problem with that, of course, is when they're healthy, you want to keep them healthy. And that's not fully appreciated by those who aren't enrolling their children.
I want to talk a bit more about the funding, but the funding and the quality questions have to be addressed. And one of the things I think that the surveys show is that many people who have insurance are profoundly dissatisfied with it. They feel that it's very cumbersome to access. I mean, particularly I find there are complaints across the board, whether people are in HMOs or PPOs. They feel that, you know, you have to wait too long for appointments. They feel that they are not given adequate time with their physicians. They feel that they're being pushed out of the, you know, out of the examination even before they've had a chance to fully express their concerns. Do you envision that this plan, if it does succeed in bringing down costs and bringing more people into the system, what will that do to address complaints about quality?
I think that the problem in this arena is, of course, you hear the complaints more than the satisfaction. By and large, in fact, if you survey people with coverage from large employers, they're basically pretty satisfied with their coverage. There's complaints about waits or other things. But by and large, the real problems in the system aren't with people like yourself and myself who have coverage from big employers who are picking up most of the cost. The big problem is people who don't have access to that kind of insurance, the people who are uninsured or who are forced in this non-group insurance market. That's where the real dissatisfaction lies, and that's what this plan is designed to address.
The estate appropriated only $125 million of additional funding for the new plan. What happens if the state's revenues fall or if the plan doesn't bring down the cost of insurance as expected? Was that discussed? And what do you do?
That's a good question. Obviously, the financing is very important here. The financing for the first 3 years is clearly plenty. When we assessed the financing needed, we were very conservative in terms of assuming, I think, probably even more uninsured than there actually are in the state. And we were very comprehensive in how we assess those costs. So I think that the funding is clearly there for the first few years. Beyond that, a lot of it has to do with what's going to happen to healthcare costs. And in particular, what's going to be key is how the state resolves this tension between, on the one hand, not wanting costs to go up too much, and on the other hand, guaranteeing comprehensive insurance for everyone. That's the tension that may come out down the road.
Let's talk about the premiums for the plans. I know that you said that it's really a framework and, you know, policy and details to, you know, program to follow the framework. The cost depends on the income level. What are you envisioning, and how do you determine what's affordable for each income bracket?
That is really ultimately a political question. I mean, the main thing we need to do is assess what each income bracket would have to pay, and then ultimately it's up to the people who are going to run this connector to define what affordable is. Remember, on the one hand, we'd like to think that affordable people should spend a small amount of income on health care. On the other hand, let's not forget that the nation as a whole spends 16% of our income on health care. One in every $6 in America runs through the health care sector. That says that affordable might be, you know, not 16% of income, obviously, but a fairly, you know, a sizable share of income. And that's just something that's going to have to be debated.
Excuse me, Professor, we need to take a short break. We're talking about Massachusetts' plan to provide near universal health care for its residents. Will it work? And is it an example for other states to follow? We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Michelle Martin. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington. Lawmakers in Massachusetts passed a bill last week that promises near universal health care coverage for residents. You can learn more from Governor Mitt Romney about the promise and potential pitfalls of the Massachusetts law. And you can also find out how the law would affect businesses and individuals at our website, npr.org. Our guest is Jonathan Gruber, a health economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And Professor Gruber, let's go right to some questions. Let's go to Boston and Stephanie. Stephanie, what do you have to say?
Hi. I'm a student, and I live in Boston. Obviously, my rent is very high. And I'm right now in a, because I have a health issue, I have to pay non-group rates. I'm paying $570 a month in health insurance, on top of whatever co-pays are applicable. And I do that through student loans, et cetera. It's very, very costly. And my insurance goes up approximately 20% a year. The past 2 years, it's gone up 20%. So I'm wondering, first of all, what are going to be my options once this law goes into effect, and, you know, how other people in similar situations can be helped, because it's a lot of money.
And Stephanie, it sounds like you're concerned about it. I mean, it sounds like this is very anxiety-inducing for you.
I don't know how I'm going to pay next month's, you know, $570 bill because, you know, it's, what are we, in April? And, you know, student loans that come in January start to run out, you know, if you have to pay Boston rents plus, plus that kind of health insurance cost. It's, you know, those two are my biggest cost.
Okay. Okay, hold on, Stephanie. Thank you. Let's hear what Professor Gruber has to say about that.
Stephanie, you're exactly an example of why we need this kind of reform. The system is failing those who don't have access to good, fairly priced insurance. And by fairly priced, I mean the fact that sick people don't pay that much more than healthy people, that there's a pool where everybody bears the burden of these health costs, and you're not in that pool. You're in the non-group market, where the prices are high and, as you said, incredibly volatile. And that's exactly what this plan is designed to address.
And why would that? Because it would broaden out the number of people participating, so she wouldn't be isolated with other people who are similarly disadvantaged by a health problem?
Exactly. It's for two reasons. First of all, it's that reason. Second of all, the people who insure Stephanie, even if she wasn't sick, even if Stephanie wasn't sick, she'd still be paying a huge amount of money for health insurance. And the reason is because the insurers are worried that everybody who comes to them is sick. So they price as if everyone is, even though not everyone is. With this pool, knowing they have a broad distribution of the population, like works at a large firm, they can price it fairly and give everyone a price that averages those costs of the sick and the healthy. So that's the first thing. So right away you're talking about, once again, the numbers aren't nailed down, but for example, taking your cost down from $587 to maybe $300 a month. You know, it could be plus or minus some there, but that's the order of magnitude. So already you're talking about cutting it in half. And then the next step is the fact that if you're low income, if you're below the poverty line, that'll be free. If you're below three times the poverty line, so as an individual, maybe below about $30,000 a year in income, that'll be pretty heavily subsidized. So that both you'll already be getting a break just from the having fairly priced insurance. In addition, that insurance, if you're low income, will be subsidized.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie.
Can I just add one more point?
Which briefly.
It really frustrates me that I'm paying my own health insurance, and lawmakers who don't seem all that concerned, I mean, obviously now in Massachusetts, but like federal lawmakers, through my taxes, I'm paying partly for their health insurance, and they're not helping me out with mine. So I just want to say that is very frustrating to me.
Okay, thanks. It's an interesting point. Thank you, Stephanie. Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
And let's go to Beverly, Mass. And Dan, what's on your mind?
Hi, how are you? First of all, I'd like to say ditto to everything Stephanie said. I'm from Massachusetts, and while I'm not in a non-group coverage, I've got a group insurance plan that I get through a business group. I'm self-employed. It's costing me $10,000 or $11,000 a year. And the number that I'm hearing bantered about is those that are at 300% of the poverty level, which I think represents roughly $50,000 income for a family of three, would be eligible for some deduction in their insurance. Well, for those of us who are a little bit or slightly above that, it's not going to help us. And so that's my concern, that those of us who are somewhere in the middle of making a little too much to be able to get help from this are going to hurt the most. You know, the plan that's being bantered about that originally was going to cost $200 a month, and now they're saying, well, maybe more like $300 a month for a single person. We're still not clear on just what that's going to cover and how much better off we're going to be. When I first started in business for myself 20, 25 years ago, I could get a good plan for about $160 for a family. Now, obviously, those days are long gone, but now every year I'm facing 10 to 20% increases, and my only chance to reduce my costs is to increase my deductible. So as I said, I'm in a position now where I'm paying $10,000 or $11,000 a year, no coverage for prescriptions and high deductibles, high copays, and it's essentially a catastrophic policy.
Okay.
So I'm just curious how the state's going to resolve that, and as Stephanie said, if everybody else has got health insurance, why aren't they concerned about the rest of us who have to pay for it?
Okay, thank you, Dan.
You bet.
Professor Gruber, what about that point? And it does speak to the question I asked earlier, thank you, Dan, because it speaks to this question of people who are beyond this level of subsidy but still feel that they are paying too much, certainly more than they'd like to pay for coverage that they don't consider particularly adequate. What about that?
Well, I think Dan is raising probably the biggest issue the program faces, which is people above the subsidized range but where $10,000 a year is still a very large share of their income and more than we might consider affordable. And really, there's one of three things has to happen. One is either the state has to recognize that and come up with a larger amount of money for subsidies and extend the range in which individuals are subsidized. Secondly, the state has to find a way to make available lower-cost insurance. It sounds like Dan has already got some fairly non-comprehensive health insurance. But there are, you know, the state can come up with plans which are even cheaper, which are still real insurance, but which are not the kind of insurance we're used to getting where everything's covered. The third is there actually is in the legislation an affordability clause which states that this mandate shall only apply to individuals who can afford insurance, to be defined. Now, while that's to be defined, I can guarantee that if you're making $50,000, Dan, and it's $10,000 for insurance, which is 20% of your income, that's not going to be considered affordable. And in that situation, if we can't come up with one of the two solutions, what's going to happen, quite frankly, is the mandate will just be partial and some people will be exempt from it. That's not obviously a very savory solution. It doesn't get us to universal coverage. But unless we can come up, solve the problem through one of the other two routes, that's where we'll end up.
Let's go to Jeff in Miami, Florida. Jeff.
Hi. My question is, how does this work out to be anything but a subsidy for the insurance industry? Because you're requiring people to purchase private plans from an industry that's already horribly broken.
Okay. Professor Gruber, what do you say?
Well, I think we have to focus on the part of the industry that's horribly broken. The industry which sells me my insurance through MIT is not broken. It functions very well. Yes, the costs are higher than, say, in Canada, where it's government-run health insurance. But as a private business goes, it's really quite a good functioning business. I'm satisfied with my choices, as most people in large firms are. The real place it's broken is for individuals who don't work for these large firms, who don't have access. That's where the industry's broken. That's where the costs are high and unpredictable. The coverage is not very good. And that's where we're going to try to solve the problem by putting these people in the same kind of pools that that large firms have access to.
Jeff, was that persuasive?
Because of my experience with both the large firm and the individual pool, which I'm in now, and the fact that this cost appears to be ultimately going to be borne by small businesses, by individuals, and all the money is going to continue to flow up to the insurance companies, and they're not having to cut their rates, realize efficiencies of scale or anything else. No, it's not a terribly convincing argument.
Okay, thanks for calling. Well, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks. You know, you mentioned, Professor Gruber, you mentioned Canada. There are a lot of people in this country who still have an attraction to one of two polar opposite positions. One is, a lot of people say, look, we're headed toward a single-payer system anyway. There's so much government involvement now in providing health care, particularly for the elderly and for the low income, that really that's the logical next step. Why don't we just get over ourselves and go there? And then the other perspective is that why don't we just try to cut out as much bureaucracy as possible and go to health savings accounts and really try to manipulate the system, and that's not meant to be a negative word, but you know, intervene through the tax system, through like health savings accounts. So did you consider either of those two models, and why did you not pursue either of those?
Well, Michelle, I think you very well categorized sort of the left and the right views on this, and I think both of those have serious limitations. I think the problem with the national health insurance approach, there's a policy problem, which is that it's not clear that Americans want a government entity choosing their health benefits package, which is what happens if you're in Canada. They tell you what's covered and what's not covered, and you live with it. It's not clear that's the right thing to do. We might want to reflect more different people's tastes for different kinds of insurance coverage. Second of all, I think, quite frankly, we waste a lot of time discussing that in the U.S. context. The U.S. private health insurance industry earned $100 billion in profits last year. That industry isn't going away. And any solution that doesn't involve that industry in a constructive way in reforming healthcare is doomed to defeat. So that sort of motivates the right solution, which is, okay, let's buy that industry and let's give tax subsidies for people to go get health insurance. The problem with that is you're sending them to a place where the market's broken. This comes back to Jeff's earlier point. He may have problems with large group insurance, but we got to admit the problems are even greater when individuals go out and try to buy insurance on their own. And just you're basically throwing good money after bad if you just subsidize people to go out and get health insurance. You need to both provide a place for them to go and provide subsidies for them to do that. And so that's why this approach tries to sort of bring the private sector along, which I think is critical, quite frankly, to any feasible reform. And then it also does so in a subsidized way.
Let's go to Kansas City, Missouri. John?
Hi.
Sounds like you're in a windy place, John.
Since I live in Missouri down here, would something like what you guys are doing in Massachusetts work for a state like Missouri?
Hey, thanks, John. And I'm going to put you on hold because it's very windy where you are. That's okay. Professor?
Yes.
I think it speaks to a question. That Massachusetts is a pretty affluent state. The percentage of the uninsured lower than it is in a lot of other places. What about John's point? Is this the kind of program that could work in a place like Texas where you've got like 25% of the population is uninsured?
Well, I think that, you know, the big issue that's been debated has been the exportability of this idea to other states. I think there's two answers to that. One is the structure is easily exportable, this basic notion of a central purchasing mechanism that we call the connector, subsidizing low-income people, an individual mandate. There's no reason that couldn't work anywhere, even at the national level. The big problem is financing. Of course, that's a bit like saying, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? The financing is a big issue, and it would be much more expensive in a place like Texas than it was in Massachusetts. And that may be why to go beyond the handful of states that are wealthy and have a low number of uninsured may require federal intervention.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take another caller in Washington, D.C. And Kara, what's on your mind?
Yes, I'm a physician working for the federal government. And a question that I had is that the system I work in right now is relatively rationed health care. And it sounds like a good portion of the patients who are going to be coming into your system are going to be doing that. How are you going to make arrangements to ration health care in an appropriate fashion? I'll give you an example. When some of the lifestyle-type agents, Viagra, Levitra, et cetera, came on the market, those were fully covered, whereas things like women's ability to provide themselves with adequate birth control was not covered. And are you going to be teaching the patients as well as the providers how to appropriately access this care so as not to run the costs even further up? And I'll take my answer off the line.
Okay. Thanks, Kara. Thanks for calling.
You know, that's a good question. It actually comes back a bit to, Michelle, your earlier question about national health insurance, which is when you have one national health insurance plan, it's exactly the kind of decisions you have to make. When you have a purchasing pool through which many private entities can offer health insurance, you don't have to make that decision. Some insurers can offer full coverage and charge a higher premium. Other insurers can offer less full coverage above some minimum standard and charge a lower premium, and that's exactly what you'd want to. That's a reason to have a private solution to this problem, to allow that to be reflected. That said, there's still a large government role here in deciding what the minimum standards are. You know, insurers may be able to exceed those, but does the minimum standard include Viagra? That's going to be the kind of hard decision that this connector is going to have to figure out. I think that the governor has stated strongly he'd like the minimum to be a fairly low minimum to make sure that there's comprehensive insurance, but that's not too expensive. I think other state lawmakers want the minimum standards to be very generous, and that's something we'll have to figure out.
Just very briefly, Professor, because we're running out of time, you know, in a number of developing countries, school fees were the norm, and that a number of countries, as part of reform, and have eliminated school fees, and they had a huge influx of students coming into the schools, and obviously people very eager to learn. But the people who are kind of existing and participating in the system, very angry about this because all of a sudden that they see the quality diminish as more of these kids who've never been in school before come in and obviously want to participate. And so I'm wondering if the same thing might be true here, that a lot of people who've gone without health care for quite some time finally have access to service and then come in with pre-existing conditions that have gone untreated for a while, there are potential costs that are larger than you anticipated because you're doing a social good, but also because you see what I'm asking? I mean, you're trying to do the right thing, but are there costs attached to doing the right thing that perhaps have not been anticipated?
You know, you're exactly right. A number of these uninsured individuals who will be brought into the system are quite ill, and that is exactly a good reason to do this, like the earlier caller who was a student who had a medical condition that caused high prices. That's why you need a social intervention in this area. That said, when we developed the financing mechanism and estimated the cost, we tried to account for that to the extent possible, looking at the characteristics of who's uninsured to try to estimate that. You can't predict it perfectly, but to the extent we're a bit wrong and the costs are a bit higher because people are a bit sicker than we realized, that doesn't really bother me.
Well, thank you, Professor. Very exciting stuff. Come back and talk to us when the program gets further along and keep us updated. I hope you will.
Will do. Thanks a lot, Michelle.
I want to thank my guest for joining us. Jonathan Gruber is a health economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He joined us from a studio at Barkland Productions in Watertown, Massachusetts. And when we come back from a short break, a new law will require anyone seeking Medicaid coverage to show proof of U.S. citizenship. And it's Tuesday. We'll read your letters. I'm Michelle Martin. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.